Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for your participation. Basically, I'm Pejman Abdulmohammadi from the LSE Middle East Center, and we are very happy to have here with us Professor Ali Ansari, who joined the LSE Middle East Center as a visiting professor. He is a visiting professor here right now, but of course he is professor of Iranian history and the founding director of the Institute for Iranian Studies at the University of St. Andrews. He is also senior associate fellow at the Royal United Service Institute and president of the British Institute of Persian Studies. Basically, so we are very happy to have Ali here today, particularly that is happening after the election of United States. So I think it would be very interesting discussion, hopefully. And the title, as you all have noticed, is Revisiting Rouhani's Election, the Politics of Managing Change in Iran. And I think Ali will go to have a 20 minutes around the talk, and then we will go for the Q&A. I'm asked here, of course, to communicate that the event will be recorded, so once that you're in a Q&A, you might be a bit with the voice. We should try to work on technical thing to record everything. And of course, also it's they're asking to silence their phones and trying to proceed for the talk. So I really don't want to steal time from our important guest now and a distinguished guest. I pass the word to Ali Ansari. Thank you very much. Please.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Pejman. I'm going to... Wait till you heard what I said. That's very gracious of you. I'm going to stand, partly because that light is blinding me as I sit down. But I think standing over here might be a little bit to the side. Turn what off? Oh, OK. Well, I'm happy to stand. It means my watch won't tell me to stand every 10 minutes. So, this is a paper that I actually wrote after the 11th presidential elections in Iran back in 2013 and all the hype that followed it. And it was interesting for me, actually, that such was the enthusiasm over that election that in some ways this became sort of superseded by various other events that were taking place, particularly this excitement over the possibility of having the nuclear issue resolved. So it's a little bit late in being published in the form it was. There was an abridged version or a much shorter version that was issued as a briefing paper. Some of you will find some of it familiar in that sense, but this is a much longer and more detailed account of the election itself. And the reason I was keen to get it published in a sense is, as some of you are aware, I'd written quite a long study on Khatami's presidency, the politics of managing change, which originally came out with Chatham House in 2000 and then looking really up until 2005. And one of the things I was very keen or interested in was to look at the parallels that people were drawing between Rouhani's election in 2013 and the reform movement at Khatami back in sort of 1997-2005, and to see whether these parallels were really justified, the intervening, shall you say, intervening years of the Ahmadinejad presidency had affected politics in Iran. And I was very struck, actually, by the way in which the media in particular, punditry, if you will, other commentators, were very willing, in a sense, to buy into a particular narrative of Rouhani's election. And this was basically that Rouhani's election, obviously, was a great, both a shock, I mean, although we're getting used to shocks these days, it's not quite the shock it used to be. It was a surprise. It showed the dynamism of Iranian elections, that Iranian elections were actually something that we could take seriously, that this also provided us with an opportunity, in a sense, for a new opening. And a lot of it was driven, and I was very struck by this, by the fact that many in the West felt, and I think this was probably right, of course, they had missed an opportunity with Khatami, that they had bungled it with Khatami in some ways, and as a result of 9/11 and all the things that happened after that, and that this offered them a second chance, and they weren't going to forego this one. This one they were going to make extra efforts with. But I was also struck by the fact that the Iranians also, certainly the Iranian establishment, if you want to call it the deep state or the shadow state, although it's neither deep nor shadow anymore really, that they were also aware of this need. They were also aware of this need, and they sort of, in a sense, played to it. So the narrative, as it was, really was of this election process that was unpredictable. And therefore, if it was unpredictable, therefore it had to have a sort of an element of serious democracy about it. Often these words were used rather loosely, that Rouhani sort of symbolized this clean break, in effect, with the preceding 8 years, certainly Ahmadinejad. And there is an element, of course, in all these narratives of truth insofar as obviously Rouhani did represent, and those around him certainly did represent, a break with Ahmadinejad and the preceding administration, and the fact that if you talk to the people in Rouhani's administration, they absolutely loathe. They don't just loathe, they really loathe the Ahmadinejad administration. They want to put enough distance between them. But for me, if you looked at the detail of that election process, it struck me that it wasn't quite as different as some people were trying to say, that there was much more negotiation in the electoral process than people would have accepted. We tended to sort of not want to look at the detail, of course, because the detail looks a bit messy. I know one Iranian official did say to me once, you know, the beauty thing about Iran is never look too close. If you look in too much detail, it looks a little bit too messy. But if you look from a distance, you get a nice broad picture. The sunlit uplands are there, and you can see that you can see in a sense what you want to see. And one of my criticisms, really, of the whole approach and reception of Rouhani and Rouhani's election and others, is that it failed to manage expectations properly by elevating the whole election of Rouhani and the individual himself into realms that, frankly, were completely unrealistic. So the first thing I really want to look at is whether we could see Rouhani, in a sense, as a successor or a sort of a carbon copy or a successor to either Khatami or even Rafsanjani. Certainly Khatami and Rafsanjani were pivotal to his success in 2013. There's little doubt about it that Rafsanjani, in a sense, managed the sort of elite backing that they had for him. But also Khatami, as he did, of course, last year, was it this year, I think earlier this year, was basically brought out people to vote for him as far as possible. But one of the things that people often didn't look at in sufficient detail, I suppose, was the way in which the hardline elite was dramatically split over the legacy of Ahmadinejad, and that in this way Rouhani was able to exploit that gap. That what you saw here was an establishment that was divided amongst itself. It was very clear when you looked at people like Nadir Nouri, for instance, who was in the leader's office. He was the one person, I have to say, who predicted Rouhani's victory. And it's quite interesting that right within the leadership office there was this view that Ahmadinejad was bad news. There were problems, obviously, with the sanctions that were growing, but the main thing about Ahmadinejad's bad news, in a way, was because he had really broken a number of red lines as far as the leader's authority was concerned, and also his ambitions, I suppose, in different ways, in terms of the political establishment and his challenge that he was making on other levels. And he was also, to see the his second cousin twice removed, I won't mention him, Donald J. Trump, you know, he had this sort of like attitude of basically being able to abuse people at great ease, even by the standards of Iranian politics, which had got extremely vulgar during the Ahmadinejad years, where people abused each other with sort of great relish. Ahmadinejad had taken it to lengths that were really quite dramatic, and we saw that in a number of the, certainly in 2009 during the election debates and others, that a lot of the sort of senior establishment figures, very hawkish in their own right, very hardline and others, even they were basically appalled at this. So there was a sort of a, what I have termed in this paper and others, a sort of a baronial revolt. And this elite fracture was very important in allowing, in a sense, this Rouhani push to come through. But even then, if you look at the negotiation that was going on at the time, it was always, in some senses, a bit of touch and go, although, as we've now seen, probably slightly less touch and go than we would have assumed, because a lot of people, certainly the narrative was, here comes a new face, here comes someone to sort of break through the old hardline visage of the time, now we can start on a nuclear negotiation. We now know from the sources, of course, that the nuclear negotiations, in some ways, particularly between Iran and the United States, had started before Rouhani came into office, and that Rouhani himself seemed to be quite shocked about the level of engagement that had already taken place, certainly between Salehi and American interlocutors in Oman. So while I wouldn't want to go so far, by the way, to say, although, you know, the leadership office would like to say it was all rather fixed and staged from beforehand, I don't think that's true. I think that's a stage too far. It certainly, you know, allows us to pause for thought in a way about this fact that Rouhani's arrival made such a seminal change to the entire process. Clearly some sort of process was already taking place. So the election itself was one which I think was much more managed than people accept. I mean, the Iranian elections, as I've written, even the recent one that we've seen, really occurs in three stages. There is a sort of negotiation beforehand, the actual process of voting, and then there's the negotiation that happens afterwards. with normally the Guardian Council, but also the elite. So you saw this at the time. There was a very detailed negotiation that took place to see who would be acceptable and who wouldn't. And it helped, of course, in Rouhani's case, that he was at least articulate, that he was able to answer questions with a degree of sensibility, and that his main challenger, really, at the time, who many people thought was the leadership favourite, was Saeed Jalili, who most people found completely incomprehensible. And, of course, the joke at the time was that Iranians would tweet and other things that, you know, Catherine Ashton had come back, all is forgiven, we now know what you had to put up with. I mean, this sort of like the commentary that Jalili would make at a number of his interviews made him in some ways unelectable, although we have to bear in mind that in Iran, of course, when we talk about, as I said, the actual voting procedure, the voting procedure is one aspect of the process. Now, what about Rouhani himself? I think the view of Rouhani himself, Rouhani, when he moved, when he was campaigning for elections, certainly campaigned in poetry before governing in prose. And the poetry was extremely florid, and the prose has proved rather dull. And this contrast has been quite striking for him. Now, let's go to the poetry first of all, because I think here we have something that, you know, we need to be, that people have in some ways brought in for. And I reserve quite a bit of criticism, I think, for some of the commentariat, if I can use that word, and also some of the press, who took this rather too much at face value. But I'll take a couple of examples for you. A well-known journalist in this country, who is referenced in the book, I won't name him, but he's there, among others, all commented at the time, for instance, that Rouhani is obviously a deeply civilized man because he's fluent in several languages. And at the time, when he came in, they decided he was so fluent that he was fluent in six languages. I was always puzzled about what these six languages were. I mean, you could easily run out, but a number of journalists took this on board and said, this is a man of, you know, he's a polymath, he's very good. And even more, he did a PhD in Glasgow. And because he did a PhD in Glasgow, this clearly made him British in some way or form. And as a result, he understood politics. Now, the thing about Rouhani, which I always found, and I'm afraid, you know, I'm a stickler for these things. First of all, he wasn't entirely transparent over where his PhD was from or when he got it. So in actual fact, he'd been calling himself Dr. Rouhani for many, many years before he actually technically got this PhD. Then he announced on his website that he got his PhD in the University of Glasgow. So naturally, I rang up friends in the University of Glasgow and said, oh, by the way, can you get hold of this thesis? It'd be interesting to see what it is. It turned out it wasn't the University of Glasgow. It turned out that it was the Glasgow Caledonian. Glasgow Caledonian, as you know, is one of the other post-1992 universities, to use the polite term. And he apparently claims to have been in Glasgow in the late 1990s, writing his thesis. Fine, I don't want to object to that necessarily. However, he was also at the same time apparently in the National Security Council of Iran. So it would have been quite interesting for me that Hassan Rouhani was actually sitting in Glasgow while he was also running sort of national security strategy for Iran at the end of the 1990s. I don't think it's feasible, but nonetheless, he may have done it by distance learning, so fair enough. At the same time, as I said, there were elements there that I thought people could have been a little bit more critical of. The language issue, of course, was very clear. And for those of you who want to have a look, I think basically he's fluent in Persian and a little bit of Arabic. I don't think his English is up to much. But people said, oh, he's fluent in English. But you're welcome to go and have a look at his interviews in English and you can tell me whether you think he's fluent. The point really was is that too many people were willing to accept this at face value without doing even the most basic checks. Okay? And one of the other things, for instance, if you look at it, he made a number of enormous promises at the head of the election in order to galvanize the vote about all the sort of things that reformists were interested in Iran. One in particular, which I found very interesting, was his Charter of Citizens' Rights. Now, this was a very important step in some way. Unfortunately, very few people bothered to go and read this Charter for Citizens' Rights. I'm sorry to say that the latest EU report on Iran actually quotes this as a major step forward. And I do wonder whether they've actually read the Charter for Citizens' Rights. Because if you look at it, first of all, it hasn't actually been ratified yet. What it's saying in the EU report is they're very pleased to say that he's moving in the right direction. But this Charter of Citizens' Rights, in a sense, is, to put it politely, a work in progress. It was promised ahead of time. It's taking a very long time to move from gestation to something more serious. And if you look at it and if you read it, rather than just look at the title, you'll find that the citizens' rights are not the sort of rights we would consider inalienable. What they are basically rights that are afforded to Iranians as long as they don't contravene the tenets of Islam. Now, that is a hell of a condition. And if you look at it, it doesn't really mean a huge amount. Okay, so what you find with Rouhani is, in terms of his politics, he made a lot of very big promises. I think they were promises that were encouraging, but the point was, is I think expectations were raised, and expectations were raised that may or may not be fulfilled. You saw the same about the house arrest of, obviously, the Green Movement leaders. It was said at the time that within 6 months they'll be released. I mean, we're still waiting. So there are things about that. I think, you know, people could have been a little bit more, I suppose, critically engaged with, and I don't think we were. And I don't think we were, in part, because everything was being dominated by the nuclear agreement and the idea that we wanted to get a nuclear agreement above all else. Now, this is not a bad thing. It's certainly, I would say, a good thing. But I do think it's worrying when that sort of political expedient or that political target really gainsays anything else that you're trying to do. And Rouhani himself, of course, made this sort of argument that the nuclear agreement would be the key that would unlock all the other problems that the country faces. It's an enormous gamble, if you think about it, and, well, after the 8th of November, it's an even bigger gamble, to be perfectly honest with you. But what his argument basically was if we get this nuclear agreement sorted out, if we get the sanctions lifted, this will unleash, in a sense, the talents, the ability, obviously, in the Iranian economy and other things. This is what we have to work towards. This is what we rely on. Interestingly, from an American perspective, and this is where my other, I suppose, my critique of the Obama administration's handling of all this has been, is what they have done is they depend on him being able to make a success of this. So what we have is this curious circular, almost a vicious circle, if you will, of dependency between the White House and the Iranian presidency. That the Iranian presidency depends on its success on the White House delivering, the White House depends on its success on Rouhani delivering. And each side is saying, well, get on and deliver then. But the point is, they're not really actually willing to take the necessary steps to encourage confidence, because there are also, of course, hawks on either side that will do their utmost to sabotage you. And one of the problems in that sense of the JCPOA, which has been held up as this great diplomatic triumph, and I think as a transactional agreement it certainly works, I think as a sort of a peace in our time document, it's had its problems, and if it stalls, it basically dies. And I think this is the problem that we face now, that he is finding that many of the economic benefits that he might have hoped to gain from it are, at the very least, going to take longer than he thought. Now, it doesn't help, of course, that classically, in his own way, he indulged in enormous rhetoric about what the JCPOA involved. In his own eyes, it involved the complete lifting of sanctions and the breaking of the sanctions regime, which, as we know, is not actually true. So, both in a political sense and in an economic sense, which are closely intertwined, of course, what you have found is that Rouhani, in a sense, the election of Rouhani, the reception of Rouhani in that sense, has led to expectations which I always thought were going to be extremely difficult to deliver. And if you don't manage those expectations well, of course, what you're going to get is a level of disappointment which is going to rebound on him. And this is where I think he finds himself now. There was a very interesting comment by the head of the judiciary, I thought it was a very pointed comment, Sadir Larijani, about a week ago, which was, mischievous in the extreme, but nonetheless it probably hit the target, because Rouhani had got up at the annual, whatever it was, press day, whatever, in Iran, the celebration of the press, talking about freedom of the press and how we need to have a free press and we mustn't curtail freedom of speech. And Sadir Larijani very pointedly said, I don't know why the president goes off in public and makes these speeches, because in private, when he talks to us, he always says he wants to keep the press under control. And of course, what he's saying in saying like that, he's saying something that many Iranians believe, which is a problem, that he says something in public, but he does something else in private, that he makes a good speech about civil rights and political freedoms and economic liberalization on one level, but in private, actually, he's quite happy to basically toe the line as far as the leadership is concerned. So that is a problem, and I don't think we, see that collectively in the West, certainly the journalists and the commentary and others, have been really sharp enough to see, really, or critical enough to see where these failings might be. We've been too willing to read into the sources, in a sense, what we want to see. And it's a pity, but we see it all the time. We've just seen it in the United States, of course. It's that willingness to basically read the read the data as we want to. I mean, a crucial one, if we want to take the American parallel, is the rise of the Hispanic vote in Florida, without realizing that the rise of the Hispanic vote in Florida was really Cuban Americans who didn't like Mexicans. So, I mean, it's you have to be a little bit more, you have to dig a little bit deeper than reading the headline news. So this is, I think, an issue. Now, the JCPOA...
You're in time.
I'm just going to say one final thing about it, because this is a real bee in my bonnet, which I've had a real sort of struggle with a number of people with, and I'm sure not everyone's going to agree with me on this, but I want to draw this parallel. Because I think this is one of the big mistakes of the Obama administration, if I have to tell you, and that is this nuclear fatwa. Now, as a number of you know, if you've actually followed anything I've said, actually, is that I'm not a great fan of the nuclear fatwa, and let me tell you why. So you'll see why I think sometimes political expediency has got in the way of a longer strategic vision. Some of you will remember the Rushdie fatwa. And the Rushdie fatwa was solved in a diplomatic agreement by 1998. At the time, Robin Cook was the foreign secretary here, and Kamal Kharazi was the foreign secretary of Iran. And it was an interesting diplomatic solution, because what the Iranians said, they said, the fatwa is a religious... First of all, there was a whole decade of discussion of whether it was a fatwa or not, by the way. I mean, it was fascinating for those of us who are interested in Shia jurisprudence. We had to work out whether it was a hukm or it was a fatwa, or whether Khomeini had actually read the book or he hadn't read the book, or what had happened, or whether someone asked him a question or whatever. Anyway, we went round and round the circles. It became a major cause célèbre, obviously. And finally, in 1998, the Iranian government under Khatami basically accepted. They said, look, this is a religious edict, and as a religious edict, it is not applicable to the secular government. The government will not pursue the fatwa. Okay, here, interestingly enough, the press reported that the fatwa had been lifted. It hadn't been lifted. What we'd had was a classic diplomatic fudge, a very good one, and it worked. Because basically the Iranians went back and said, well, we've kept the fatwa in place, but we're not going to pursue it. The fact that we have a £15 million bounty on the guy's head doesn't matter. That's a religious charity. This is what charities do. Okay, so we're going to leave the... we're not going to pursue it. And on the British side, of course, they said, we can solve it, we can get back, we can open our embassy, the British Council can go, we can do all sorts of exciting things. What that did, of course, in a very interesting way as a diplomatic solution, is that overnight, basically, the Iranian government admitted in a practical way that it is secular. But the Islamic Republic became, through this agreement, effectively a secular government. Because it said, this is a religious edict, we don't pursue that, that's in the religious sphere. Leave the religious people to get on with that. We are the government. We are the political government of the Islamic Republic. We won't deal with it. Fast forward 10 years, and you have the nuclear fatwa that nobody's ever seen, by the way, but let's accept Khamenei's word that he's issued this fatwa. Most fatwas have to be written, certainly on an important issue like this, but nonetheless, let's accept that Khamenei, by voicing his concerns, has issued a fatwa. I always find this very problematic, of course, because, you know, what it means is that Khamenei can pick and choose whatever of his utterances are religious edicts, which is a pretty powerful position to be in, if he decides one morning to issue. And if you want to go and look at Khamenei's fatwas, he's got a website, and he lists them all. And some of them are very interesting. Some of them do with satellite dishes, others do with buying things from Israel, and so on and so forth. But they're written. You know, they're written answers to questions. And you're yet to find anything on the nuclear issue on there, by the way. Nonetheless, he says it's a fatwa. What I find extraordinary is that the White House accepts the notion of the fatwa. And so the White House, and Obama in particular, has taken this, because he thinks it's useful for getting his deal done, he's basically said that we have legitimized this religious edict. We accept this as a form of international policy or international diplomacy. And I would say to American colleagues, I said, listen, if Khamenei wants to issue a fatwa against nuclear weapons or the use of nuclear weapons, great. Fantastic. Let them issue it. It's for his population. It's for his thing. But I don't think it's the place of the US president to basically legitimize it. Because what you have done immediately is within Iran, you have signified that Khamenei's fatwas have some sort of international sanction, international legitimacy. And of course, it completely overturns the Rushdie fatwa in some ways. You know, the Rushdie fatwa obviously is still legitimate and valid in that sense. We've completely... This, to my mind, is the short-sightedness in some ways of the diplomacy. I quite understand it in terms of politics, but I think as a diplomatic strategy, it's wrong. What about the JCPOA and its future now? I think, certainly, because of events 2 days ago, we have a problem. Okay, and I've always said that the JCPOA works on the basis, not on the basis of of the agreement itself, but on the basis that it leads somewhere. The JCPOA is a process, and you have to understand it as a process. Because the idea was, as Obama and his classic Whig narrative of history, that the arc of history is long and it leads curves towards justice, as he keeps telling us. Well, it's curved slightly in the wrong way at the moment, but nonetheless, there is a momentum. It has to go somewhere. And at the moment, it's not going anywhere. And if it's not going anywhere, Rouhani will not get the economic benefits of what he wanted to do. But from the other side of the argument, of course, is Rouhani himself hasn't made sufficient political or economic changes to the internal structures of the country to actually attract the sort of things that he needs. So I think we're in a sort of a... we stalled effectively. I don't think the thing, I'm actually not as pessimistic as some that Trump is going to tear the whole thing up. I don't think he needs to. But I am slightly worried now that what's going to happen is that this thing will simply stall. And if it stalls and doesn't go anywhere, then we're going to find ourselves slowly but surely going back to where we were. Although this time, of course, the Iranians will have a sort of a very strong legitimate case to say that, you know, they've actually delivered on the majority of their own of their own obligations under the agreement. I'll leave it at that because I've already gone well over the...
You have four or five minutes.
That's all right. You can.
All right.
Did I say 20 minutes? Or did I,
yeah, for the 30. For the 30 you have, but for the 20 is already...
Because I've got a couple of students there will be asleep anyway, so I want to I want to keep them awake. So I'll leave it at that. And but obviously there's a lot more in there that... if you'd like to ask questions, and I think, well, you've got a good time to ask questions, so I'm happy to provide with any more detail that I can.
Well, thank you very much, Ali. It has been a wonderful, I think, a talk here, and I think that now we could really go through our Q&A section, and we have enough time to go in depth in some concept that Professor Ansari has been highlighted. I'm just going to ask to have a brief and precise question, and particularly if you kindly introduce yourself before the question. So I would just start now and open the floor, please. So let's break the ice somehow, all right? Please.
I'm Gisa. I'm a PhD student in Westminster Business School. I just wanted to make a comment on the press exhibition that you said. The Rouhani government, they get back to Sadegh Laoghani, was saying that Rouhani always complained about those newspapers, slightly the hardliners who have kind of security. Mm-hmm. So that was their comment on this issue, because you were saying that he does something publicly, but he acts otherwise privately. So this one was the comment.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a question, because I had this kind of, I thought that kind of the government of Iran is pro-Trump, and they actually, yeah, because when I went to Iran, I thought that they already promised that they wanted Trump to be president rather than Clinton being president. This was what I got from the atmosphere in Iran. And I was very confused how they wanted Trump to be elected. So do you have any explanation for that, or just...
Yeah, I mean, Peshman and I were talking about it. I agree with you. I mean, I find it also a bit confusing, but I think it's also a complete misreading of American politics. And I think a lot of people, you know, I mean, let me just come back to your comment as well first. I mean, just to clarify on that, what I'm saying is really that Laoghani exploits what people think is a perception about him. That he talks a good talk, but he doesn't do as much as he's meant to do. That's the thing, and I agree with you that he targets, you know, those papers that are... But at the same time, you know, there is a sort of anxiety that he hasn't actually delivered on a number of the political things that he's meant to deliver. But that aside, and I think, you know, Laoghani is obviously, that's what I was saying, what he said was a very political thing to say. I mean, it was deliberately intended to make him look bad. The thing about Trump is they think he's they said Tajir, basically. They think he's a businessman, or they think he's a Bazari, basically. And so, you know, I was saying, you know, in a sense, the American politics has become Iranian. You know, they've elected a merchant as their president. And the Iranians, for some reason, I mean, these are the things that they think are, they think Trump is better than Clinton. Clinton they see as a hawk, okay? They see Clinton as someone who'd be tougher on Russia and certainly take a stab in Syria. Trump they see as someone basically who is going to cut a deal and who is going to is basically much softer with the Russians and hopefully will be much easier with them in Syria. Now, here's the problem really with this analysis is that Trump has said a lot of things to different people that are quite contradictory. And we won't really know yet about, you know, what his situation is. If the sort of people he's considering to be Secretary of State are the people that we think, then we're all in a lot of trouble. Okay? And so we need to think very carefully about it. And I think the Iranians, you know, have this slightly I don't want to say idiotic, but it is idiotic, really, sort of feeling that Republicans are always better for them than Democrats. Okay? And I had exactly the same argument in 2000, where they all said, no, George W. Bush is great, because the Republicans don't talk about human rights, they like business. Yeah. Whereas the Democrats, because of Carter, it's a wonderful hangover, actually, from the Shah's period. The Democrats, you know, just the, you know, JFK was terrible, Nixon was great, JFK was terrible, Carter was terrible, you know, so on and so forth. But the Republicans are great. And it's obviously a very superficial reading. I think in this case it's a highly superficial reading. None of us really know. And you'll find there's a lot of commentary on the web chat about what Trump will or will not do. The reality of it is, and I've heard a couple of professors also at the LSE, where I think there was one on Newsnight last night and others, and I have to agree with them, the problem is we don't know. The trouble with Trump is that, you know, even when you look at his potential cabinet, I must admit one of the first things I did, and I always do, is I look to see who would potentially be in their foreign policy team. And I didn't recognize a single one of them, apart from John Bolton, which I have to say is not encouraging. Okay, so, you know, we have to wait and see. It might be, he might be this deal maker, he might pop off to Moscow, he might have a very good relationship with Putin and others, but I don't think that necessarily means, he's already, you know, the Israeli right are also very keen on Trump, so, you know, we have to see where he's going to lay his guards. And I think the Iranian political elite has made mistakes about the United States on a regular level, and it's partly because, you know, one of the great failings in Iran, to be honest, as in many other non-European or non-European, is they have very little by way of academic or policy think tanks on the world outside their immediate area. You know, there are no sort of, there is the Faculty of World Studies at the University of Tehran, but it's not great. You know, I mean, it's, you know, there are these, you know, what you need are these, you know, in terms of a proper systematic study of, say, Americas or whatever, there isn't really much. And I think they just make mistakes, and I think that's where it comes from. But it's, you know, it's this idea that he's a merchant.
Thank you very much. Let's go to the another one, please.
Before the elections, myself at least, we were looking forward.
That's a good qualification.
I was looking for the election of Rouhani as someone who's proposing himself as a model. For the sake of trying to put a stop for the secular and Sunni Shia rift, and kind of not putting a stop to it, but rather stop using it in advancing their own political agendas and rivalries. I'm not talking specific. I mean, I'm not blaming the Iranians for it. I know it takes two to play this game.
Yeah.
But nothing had changed when Rouhani came. In fact, it continued on rising. The use of Sunni Shia discussions and using it in Syria or in Iraq, and it is quite threatening for the community, whether that is in Iran or in the Arab world. But there was absolutely no change, whether that is during Khatami's time or Ahmadinejad's time or later on during Rouhani's time. So I really wonder, what is the difference between the moderates and the more hawkish faction inside Iran when it comes to this religious topic and involving it in their own
politics? Where I differ with you, of course, is under Rafsanjani and Khatami, the relationship with the Arabs in the Persian Gulf and others was actually fairly good. I mean, it was fairly, you know, constructive, certainly under Khatami. I mean, Khatami went round, you know, in his Quranic Arabic and did some fairly decent speeches. You know, Rafsanjani less so, but the relationship, for very, very pragmatic and realist reasons, because of OPEC and others, was actually reasonable. It's under Ahmadinejad that it plummeted, and it's also as a consequence of the Iraq War and the divisions that emerged in Iraq and the Saudi fears of Iranian sort of expansion, if you will, in Iraq, and then of course this is expanding into Syria. So I think there are all sorts of issues here, but I think as Pejman, I think, has written himself, you know, what you find is a government in Iran that's very, very divided between different elements, and that really since Ahmadinejad's period you find that, you know, the IRGC are taking on a very distinct foreign policy of their own, which the Rouhani administration doesn't have a huge amount of clout over. They tried very hard to bring the Syria policy under control and under foreign ministry control, but they haven't had much luck with it, because the IRGC see this as their sort of baby, as their pet project, if you will. So what you find is a very sort of, bicameral, if you will, government, and where they, one group are basically pursuing a very hawkish line, the other are talking, you know, at the other side of the mouth about, you know, peace, stability, we want to work together, we're brothers, and so on and so forth. It adds to that, you know, to the useful ambivalence, or useful, I should say, ambiguity for them where foreign policy is concerned. But at the same time, I also think that Rouhani, as a sort of the heir to Khatami and Rafsanjani, understands that if you do want to have economic development in the region, the last thing you want is heightened tensions with Saudi. I mean, you know, you don't want regional tensions. You want to be able to dampen those down. You need to have much more collaboration. And I think, you know, that problem in Iran hasn't really been solved yet. I mean, they haven't really been able to resolve it. The other aspect, of course, you have to think about is nationalism. The nationalism in Iran and also in the other parts is growing. Now, why is nationalism being encouraged in a way? I mean, as we've seen in other countries, of course, but in Iran is a particular one. We saw recently, I think October the 31st is, you know, Cyrus the Great Day or something. So now they've instituted this, and people go out en masse to Pasargad and they shout some very interesting slogans. And for the first time this year, actually, they arrested people, so they must be getting worried. You know, so this nationalism is being encouraged. Why? Because nationalism affords the regime a sort of another plank of legitimacy when it's losing its other plank. Whereas, you know, Islam or republicanism or whatever is going weaker, they can play the nationalist part. So they encourage that, and of course that's reciprocated, as you quite rightly say, from the Arab side. I mean, there are two sides to this, you know, to this debate. And, you know, the Arabs will talk about the Iranians as Safavids or Majus or, you know, all sorts of weird and wonderful things, and the Iranians will respond in kind, you know. And it's getting more and more bitter in that sense. Rouhani himself, you know, on the terms of whether Rouhani is a moderate, again, all these terms are very relative in Iran. I mean, you know, would Rouhani be, you know, my choice in the current crop? Yes, he probably would be. You know, he seems like a reasonably decent sort of person on one level. On the other hand, you know, he does come from the security and intelligence establishment. You know, he's not a, you know, he claims, of course, to be a man of the law and, you know, very literate and so on and so forth. Well, that's fine. But at the same time, you know, he's come through that intelligence establishment, which many people have used and said, of course, this shows why he will be successful, because he knows how to manage all these things. But when I was talking to Iranian colleagues, you know, for instance, said about this, I said, so it doesn't sound to me as if he's a moderate. And the classic line comes back, it depends on your definition of moderate. You know, you've got to be, you know, you've got to understand and see what he does. And I think the far better term for Rouhani is pragmatist. You know, he works the system and he knows how far he can and cannot go. And the system, and the argument really of the paper here, by the way, is you cannot ignore the 8 years that preceded him. Khatami inherited a situation from Rafsanjani. Rouhani inherited a situation from Ahmadinejad. And yes, Ahmadinejad has been barred from running, by the way, but he's still sitting at the knee of the leader. You know, he's still there as a sort of an advisor in a curious sort of way. And those 8 years prior to that have done an enormous amount of damage to the way in which the political structures of the countries work. So Rouhani has inherited a much more difficult situation. That makes it more difficult for him to operate. He's not necessarily in control of all the facets of government, much less so than even Khatami or perhaps Rafsanjani was. And I quite understand people who say, well, he's not a Khatami. Khatami was a woolly liberal, you know, obviously liberalism has gone out of fashion these days. He couldn't handle the politics. But I don't think that Rouhani is a better political player than Rafsanjani. You know, I think of what Rafsanjani couldn't do it either, at the end of the day. You know, he's probably less corrupt than Rafsanjani, but, you know, maybe a little bit of corruption goes a long way in Iran, I don't know, you know, it helps. And, not unique, obviously, but, you know, it's, you know, he was able to move the system. Sorry, I'm waffling on to you now.
Right, please, gentlemen.
I'm Leila Hinton, and I run the International Department of London Science College. My question to you was that do you think the arrest of double nationals in Iran is to weaken Rouhani's position from the government and from his presidency? And when this will end?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think, and again, these are one of these narratives that come up. So, you know, we say it's either a hybrid government or he doesn't have full control. It's there to weaken. And I think in some ways that's absolutely right. On the other hand, you know, I think for many of us looking at this for the years that we have, we sort of wonder when there will be a president or when there will be someone who will be able to actually confront this in a meaningful sense. Because at the moment, they're not particularly doing anything about it. Yeah, they talk, but I don't think they do a huge amount about it. And, you know, as I said, and I've said this with the Iranian officials as well, I said, if you know, the greatest asset that, in a sense, the Islamic Republic has, if it chose to work with, and if they talk about the Chinese model, you know, they always talk about the Chinese model, although it's interesting what the Chinese think of the Chinese model. The diaspora, you know, get together with the diaspora. The diaspora is wealthy, it's talented. It's by and large, would like to do something good, I suppose. You know. Not all of them, but you know, by and large. Why don't you sort of tap into that and do it just as, you know, Chinese Americans work in China, you know, one British Iranians or American Iranians work. If you arrest them, of course, on various charges, which are not clear, this deters people, not unnaturally. Now, the argument is, of course, is that there are elements within the system who sort of say, well, we don't want these, you know, rich foreign kids in a way coming and taking all our, taking all our jobs. But obviously, I don't think this is the case. I mean, this is, they sort of say they're coming in and showing off and whatever. I don't think that's the case. I think the case is really to, A, indicate to Rouhani that he's not in charge, to signify to other people that he's not in charge, but also to send a strong signal to the diaspora and others that things are not... things are not as safe as you think. The other thing that's come out, which is, you know, again, one of these things about the Obama administration, which I think has been a mistake, certainly in what they call in the American language, you know, optics, is this idea of ransom. That these people are being taken for ransom. And, you know, when you think, by the way, that back in January, that they sent $1.4 billion, I think it was $1.4 billion, certainly a lot. It might have been $1 billion. I think 400,000 or 400 million went there in cash through Holland. I think it was euro, not dollars, they're euro. Yeah. And they all arrived in these sort of like, you know, plane loads of cash before, you know, Jason was on it. And the Iranians themselves say, well, you know, we've got our payment, we'll let you go. I mean, of course, the Americans are quite right to say this is not a ransom payment. Right? It doesn't look great. You know, it doesn't look great. And there are people there in the regime that obviously say we got paid. You know, we got paid. I'm actually myself astonished that the President of the United States cannot afford a waiver to transfer the money in different ways. That even if the President of the United States has to transfer in cash, you know, what future for business, I have to say.
Well, thank you very much. Please.
There's been talk that if Trump begins to tear down the nuclear deal, it's likely that Khamenei may begin to put aside Rouhani for next year's elections. Now, I personally don't think it's likely that he will tear down or that Khamenei, but how likely do you think that is?
I mean, I think there's two sort of distinct processes, and I agree with you, actually. The thing about the JCPOA, which if the JCPOA stays as it is now, there's absolutely no reason for Trump to tear anything up.
Exactly.
It's actually working rather well for the Americans. You know, they've dismantled half their stuff. The US sanctions are still in place. It's bloody difficult to do business in Iran anyway, whatever you try and do. They're arresting dual citizens. I mean, there's all sorts of things that actually are doing rather well. So the thing about the JCPOA, as I've said, is that for it to be successful in the long term, it has to move forward. We have to see a gradual lifting of various sanctions. We have to see a gradual moving towards what they would say a normalization of relations. And that's not going to happen. I don't think it was going to happen last year. I said at the time, you know, the minute Khamenei comes out and says, don't think that this means, you know, that we're going to be chums, you know. Now, with Trump in place, of course, it's a different level altogether. And I do think there is something actually to think about here. It all depends on what Trump does, to be honest. It all depends on the rhetoric, it all depends on how it goes. But there is this sort of element that Khamenei may decide, as you know, the argument, if you remember, with Ahmadinejad was that we needed Ahmadinejad to cope with Bush. I always think that's a very bad argument, but anyway, you know, that's the way. So what they might suggest is actually we need someone a little bit more robust in place as president. But I don't think that has anything to do with the JCPOA per se. I think the way they killed the JCPOA is just by doing nothing.
Do you think he can afford to put aside Rouhani and bring someone else?
It depends who it was. I personally, if he was very clever about it, and he has been quite clever about it, I would keep Rouhani. I mean, he's not doing anything. So, I mean, it's fine. What they might do is get rid of Zarif. They might. But even he's doing a fairly good job, at least, of keeping, you know, I mean, as long as he's not, you know, Khatami and Ahmadinejad in their own ways challenged the internal order. But Rouhani hasn't yet really challenged the internal order. He's made good speeches, as I've said, but he hasn't taken that leap. And so at the moment, there's no, if you were being smart about it, I would leave him in place, because there's no reason. And it looks stable and it looks very sensible, and there's a lot to be gained by, you know, apparently being the bastion of rationality unlike other Western countries. You know, I mean, that's the sort of thing that you can do. You can get away with that. But he would be counting on the fact that Rouhani won't make any substantive.
Next, please.
My name is Astafa. I'm just investment advisor for Iranian market.
Okay.
And I was wondering what Rouhani, to be more specific, what he promised, and he didn't do it, in taking in mind the upscaler hardliner in Iran and the West that didn't promise what they promised. Because I can see that Rouhani is doing a great job. They dropped the inflation rate to the one digit, and there are so many foreign investors and foreign money is coming to Iran. So would you be more specific about that?
First of all, I mean, the reason the inflation rate's gone down is it's possibly because the country's in recession. Okay, I mean, that might be also a good reason. It may also be because the oil price has gone down very much. I mean, these oil price issues are not his fault, obviously. But I think if you look at there are two things you have to look out for in the way foreign business is working. You can sell Iran lots of things, okay? But investment in Iran, I suggest, is going to be much more difficult in terms of long-term investment, because various things have to be in place. We're still waiting for the Financial Action Task Force, all these other things that we find very oppressive, actually, in the West, post-2008. These need to be applied in some measure or form in Iran, and I think this is a work in progress. What Rouhani did, of course, is even last January, if you go and read what he says, whatever he says very clearly, that the sanctions are all going to be lifted. Okay, he didn't actually give the clarity that was required about the sort of sanctions that would stay in place, the fact that sanctions would be suspended, the fact, as for instance, that in all EU contracts, for instance, they have to put in something about snapback, okay, which the Iranians don't want accepted. I think this is one of the things that's causing a bit of a problem with the Airbus deal, for instance. There are all sorts of things that are basically what we would call friction on the ability of them to either sell or invest in the country. And if you look domestically, if you look at the way in which people like Zangane and the very good Minister of Economy they have, you know, Tayyip Niar and others, you know, they're saying that a lot of the structural changes that need to be made, and these are not unique to him, but let's not get it wrong. I mean, these are things that we could say from 1979 or even before that have yet to be sort of resolved within an Iranian economy. That is the creation of a private sector that actually operates as a private sector, not one that is basically tied to some sort of political power or control. So I think there's a lot of promises there that he's made about the way in which the political economy will work, which in a sense which he really hasn't really tackled yet. So there's a lot of good noises. But if you talk to, and I'm sure you go to Iran much more frequently than I do, I have to say at the moment, but if you look at the basic, you know, industrial, shall we say, framework in Iran, it's still extremely difficult in terms of business. It's different from buying things. But let me give you also an example of, in terms of economic strategy, in terms of the Boeing and Airbus sale, which is another one of the bees in my bonnet. Because I think this is fantastic, and that's great. Okay, so let's say that Iran wants to spend $46 billion buying 220 planes. Or is it 200 planes? I can't remember. Now, First of all, it's a hell of a lot of money to spend on civil airliners. We all like the idea because obviously you don't want to fly on Iran Air, which the planes are very old. Although, as I've always said to people, the 747s in Iran Air are great because you get leg room. They're from 1977, after all. But, you know, I can appreciate that they're old. So you want them. But if you're going to spend $46 billion on 200 civilian airliners, the current size of the Iran Air fleet is 46, of which I understand 27 are flying. So what you're doing is you're increasing the size of your fleet by tenfold, right? Within that, you want to buy 12 380s, the Airbus 380, you know, the double-decker. When you say to the Iranians, okay, this is a great idea, who's going to fly in these planes? Where is your market for this? Their argument is, of course, which is a classic argument that goes back pre-revolutionary, oh, well, Tehran will become a regional hub. Well, this is all great. I mean, it's an aspirational idea. But if you talk to economists, they say it's economic nonsense. You know, that Iran is going to suddenly develop this massive airline industry, overtake Turkish Airways, Emirates, you know, whatever, as and become a regional hub, build all the... Now, from a European business form, it's fantastic news. Airbus is absolutely loving it because at least the 12380 can be produced now. Iran is, you know, we're recycling the money in a classic way, as the Shah might have done, you know, to keep them afloat. But it also requires a huge amount of infrastructure building, which I'm sure the French and others would be happy to do. But above all, what it requires you to have is a really flourishing tourism and airline industry to take on Turkish Airways and others. You need a strategy for that in the long term, and I don't think they have one. And this is a problem. You know, it's basically making economic policy really, it sounds great, and I think, you know, it appeals to a certain sense of Iranian national pride, of course. But I think also you have to be sensible about it. The Shah in his day bought three Concords, you know, on a whim, because he liked it. And in a sense, he'd get away with it. They never delivered them, of course. But, you know, if you remember the Iran Air thing in Piccadilly, always had a nice model of it. It was to joke the Iranians that as far as we got as the model. But they never got the actual planes. But again, that was seen as excessive at the time, even though he had the money. But this sort of purchase, I think, again, what Iran needs is a lot of short-haul airlines to deal with domestic travel, and also regional travel, and maybe some of the sort of Far East and London and other places. But, you know, they, what was it? Right at the beginning, they said they can look forward to the time when Iran Air will be flying to New York. Okay? When? I mean, it's a great idea, but it's not, you know, it's not sensible. I think the problems economically are much more fundamental. So that's what I'm saying. I mean, I think the people in his administration know exactly what needs to be done. They know exactly what needs to be done. But boy, they're going to find a lot of resistance to getting it done. I mean, I think, and you can see that with the petroleum contract, by the way, which has taken forever to get organised, doesn't it? I mean, and I'm talking from experience from the 1990s when we had buyback, you know, and talking with oil companies then, we struggled to get a contract. Now they're talking about buyback two. I think it's probably a bit better than buyback two, but it's not exactly the sort of thing that they wanted because of the resistance that you quite rightly say. But, you know, sooner or later, that's got to give. I mean, someone has got to give if they want to get serious investment in the country.
Well, please, gentle lady, please. You wanted a question, no?
I'm giving you very long answers. I'm sorry, because I think I've got plenty of time. But
please.
But I will shorten them.
I'm an economic analyst for the Middle East as well, but not going to ask about economics.
From where?
From Twitter.
Oh, okay.
And I was wondering if from now on until, let's say, May, there is an increased rhetoric from the U.S., especially because of Trump, about whether we can
or not just be able to get rid of the deal, etc. Some sort of anti-Iran legislation. Mm. What would the Iranian counterpart do? What would come in here? What can they do over the next 3 months to respond to this? I mean, you know, what they say about what the Trump government could do, the administration could do, I mean, what they can do is very simple, actually, in one way, and that is to rescind the executive orders that Obama has put in about the JCPOA, particularly over secondary sanctions and about American subsidiaries. So if they block American subsidiaries from doing work in Iran, it's going to, you know, they can make life difficult. I mean, even today, as you know, if you look at it, the Americans are great. They sort of give you, they say, you can do business in Iran, but here's the 200-page manual that you need to read before you try it. And so this manual can just, they can add another 100 pages. So that's all they need to do, by the way. He doesn't need to do a huge amount to make life a lot more difficult. What from the Iranian side, I mean, I've always said that actually, you know, Rouhani needs to get some results. There's no doubt about it. He can do some things himself. Obviously, the other side need to open up a bit more. Although I must admit, one of the things I have to, you know, disagree in one sense. I think there are elements of the small print of the JCPOA that the Iranians did not pay enough attention to. And one seems to be this idea of having access to the US financial system, which I don't know why they did not include that in the JCPOA. Now, if that's fully restricted, there are going to be problems. For Khamenei, you see, the you have to see what were his aims. His aims, not Rouhani's aims. His aims really are to stay in power. Okay, his aims are to maintain the revolution and the purity of the revolution. Now, the UN sanctions that were on Iran were proving to be destructive. Okay, from 2011 onwards, basically, it's when it got really bad. Okay. Then there was a coalition, and through the genius that was Mottaki as foreign secretary in Iran, or foreign minister in Iran, they managed somehow, through a real effort, to get the Russians and the Chinese and others to sign up, which would be very difficult normally to do. What they've done now, of course, is they've shattered that coalition. That coalition will not come back. In my view, it would be very, very, I mean, they might get, but it would be very unlikely that the Russians, the Chinese, and the other, you know, France, Britain, America, will all agree again on putting sanctions. So he's managed to break that out. It clears the game. They can buy their S-300 missiles. They can do various other things. On the other hand, leaving it as it is makes Rouhani look weak. It weakens him. And of course, Khamenei can go ad nauseum and say, I told you so, the Americans are all crooks. You know, and look at this, it's the nonsense. I told you never to trust them. I told you that Rouhani is the Mossad of the age. You know, there he is. He's trusted in the Americans, and look what they've done to him. I told you that. So it enhances his position. I don't think he's financially feeling the pinch. And he keeps Rouhani weak, and, you know, it goes to this notion that why change him, actually? Because he gives a good speech. He keeps the liberal side of the country happy in a way. But he can't really get, you know, he has two hands tied behind his back. So I, you know, in some ways, you know, I sort of forget that actually the status quo in some ways suits them. I mean, there's nothing, you know, why change it? Why get, and for the Iranian point of view, by the way, you sit it out. You've got another 8 years or 9 years are up. The sanctions start to come off the nuclear industry. They can go ahead with their civil nuclear industry. And they've already said they want an industrial scale enrichment program. That will be the next crisis, by the way. Okay, count on it. That I don't think the Europeans and the Americans will countenance an industrial scale enrichment program, even though in the agreement that they signed, that's basically what it implies. And Salehi has said it. So what the Iranians have done basically is they've traded, you know, what we do, we think in the West, I was talking to colleagues there, I said, you know, when we negotiate, what we in the West value is time. Time is a precious commodity for us. We're always rushing around. In Iran, they have plenty of time. Time is not an issue for Iranians. If it takes us 10 years, great. We'll trade other things and we'll use the time to get what we want. Yeah. And so we always think, and they played it very well in negotiations, by the way, if you notice Kerry running around saying, I've got to get the deal by this time. Yeah, I say, fine, yeah. We can take our time. And so in that sense, I'm not sure, to be honest, that Khamenei will do anything. He can play the martyr, and it'll be marvellous, and of course it will look, and everyone will sort of criticise Trump and others. But, you know, it keeps him happy, and people will say, well, Iran, you know, did what it had to do, and the Americans aren't really dealing with it. We'll ignore the fact that there's all sorts of associated problems going on, but, you know, on the pure transactional element, there's probably no reason to do anything. Now, I should say, that doesn't mean that Trump won't do anything, by the way, and he might do something, the rhetoric might get, there might be an incident in the Persian Gulf, there might be a lot of things that will happen. And of course, that's something we can't foresee, and it might cause, you know, then there would be a reaction. I think then maybe the IRGC would want to react. But I have to say, in previous times, what I find quite interesting about the IRGC is when they're faced with such unpredictability as they might do with Trump, you'll find that they might back down a little bit more. You know, they're not that stupid, actually. They're certainly not as stupid as Ahmadinejad, I have to say. If it was Ahmadinejad and Trump, then we'd be in real trouble.
Well, thank you. Please.
I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the relationship between Rouhani and different classes of the society, because we know that during Ahmadinejad's time, especially the first term, he really spoke to the lower-income classes with the project of Meh.
Yeah,
so I wonder what Rouhani is doing.
Well, I mean, you know, what Rouhani does, and I mean, I think others could probably speak to this better than I can, but I think Rouhani really is there to speak not only to the, not really to the working, I mean, I don't like this issue of working or middle or other classes, and I don't think these, you know, I always think in Iran there's basically a ruling class and the rest, I mean, that's basically, depending on obviously your income distribution and others. But clearly, you know, Rouhani appeals to a certain, what we might term in a loose term, a middle class, an intellectual middle class. And I think, you know, what you're seeing basically is a lot of people are getting increasingly disappointed with his inability to deliver on various things. I mean, that's the point. There is, it's true to be said, you know, there is this fact that, you know, you can say the economy at least is in a slightly more stable environment. That's absolutely true, although it's not very dynamic, but it's certainly much more stable. And I think there is this view that, that you know, it's better than the alternative. You know, that, you know, if we go, we might go back, you know, that Ahmadinejad is a great bogeyman that they, you know, they worry about. But I don't, you know, I don't think he's, you know, he, I don't think he certainly speaks to the, what we call the working class in that sense. And of course, the real danger is that he will, you know, he will face a fresh challenge when it comes to this sort of election cycle that's coming, coming around now. I mean, if you look at the last in the parliamentary elections, of course, and the Assembly of Experts, you can say that, you know, that people say he did reasonably well in that, and they still appealed, you know, his constituents came out for him. Although, of course, the ambiguity of that election process, of course, is that the people that were elected to the Majlis and to the Assembly of Experts, we don't actually know what their ideological background is. I mean, they're not, it's not very clear. And the Assembly of Experts in particular was quite hilarious, actually, if you look at it. You know, they said that the 30 list in Tehran was such a splendid list, but actually, you know, the 16 that sort of came in, sorry, the 16, that, you know, eight of them were part of, you know, both the Socialist Workers' Party and the Tories, you know, at the same time. It was quite an interesting division of responsibility. So they could sort of be, you know, both sides claim victory. So, I mean, I think in Rouhani's, you know, Rouhani, to my mind, does not have an actual constituency of his own. Rouhani's constituency is really brought to him by Rafsanjani and Khatami. They're the two pillars. And, you know, as I said, in that election, really, the people that brought out the vote for him was Khatami at the end of the day. He doesn't have that. He doesn't have, in my view anyway, a similar sort of access. He appeals to a certain group of people, but I don't think he has them in a sort of a... I don't think they're his natural base in that sense. I don't think he has a natural base in that sense.
Please.
Thanks. What about...
Would you introduce yourself, Chester?
So,
thank you.
Because I know who you are, but... I'm a PhD student at LSE. What's your take on Iran's warming relation with Russia? There's always been a relation...
Warming relationship?
Yeah.
It's hot.
There's always been a relation between Tehran and Moscow.
But yeah.
There's this sudden bilateral cooperation and multilateral ones between Iran and Russia. Why? And whether it's Rouhani's initiative or other parts of the government...
Well, you know where the relationship with Russia starts. I mean, in the post-Islamic Republic. This is probably before you were born, but during the Gulf War, the first Gulf War. That's yeah, you weren't born. Some of you will remember. You know, Saddam Hussein's Air Force flew to Tehran, you know, for refuge. It was one of the best decisions I think the Iraqi Air Force ever made, wasn't it? I mean, they sort of flew, or Saddam Hussein just had to fly his Air Force to Tehran for safekeeping. Of course, the Iranians sort of acquired all these MiGs and everything and thought, wow, they're not bad, you know. And the military-industrial complex, really, the relationship with Russia, former Soviet Union Russia, really starts there. Because, remember, Iran's military is basically Western resource until that period. During the Iran-Iraq War, they have to find, you know, resources from all sorts of other places. After that, they get these MiGs and others, they find it very difficult. Now, there is also a much tighter relationship between the IRGC and the sort of the oligarchy, shall we say, that emerges in Russia in the 1990s, but particularly in the noughties, and that's solidified by Ahmadinejad. So what you see is a sort of a brotherhood of the local mafias, if I may put it that way, you know, and they're basically a political economic link that's very tight, and then you see military engagement and others. For my part, and I've always argued, the relationship between Russia and Iran now is pretty tight. And it has been quite tight, really, for the last decade. Yeah, they don't love each other particularly. I don't see the point. I mean, I talk to Russian colleagues of mine. They say, you know, the Russians always say that the only people who lie more than we do are the Iranians. It's not a great way of sort of like, but, you know, it's not actually very good for the Russians either. But, you know, they they claim that they're, you know, that it's a pragmatic interest. But it may be a pragmatic interest. I mean, I have to say, from a historical point of view, I think it's a travesty in some ways, because if you look at Russian relations with Iran over the last 150, 200 years, it's not been great. Okay, it's had pros and cons, but it's not. It's certainly not been better than the Anglo-American relationship with Iran. Okay. But nonetheless, this is the way we are. Post-Soviet Union, the Russians need a friend, the Iranians need a friend. And there is a sort of a much tighter relationship growing up, which has now seen us in a situation where, as we know, you know, the Iranians granted the Russians access rights to air bases in Iran the first time a foreign power had that base, although they got very sensitive about it when the Russians bragged about it, but nonetheless we know that apparently that resource is available to them. Now this is more... to my mind, than simply a pragmatic relationship. This is something deeper. And when you're having Russian or Iranian troops being shipped over to Syria or whatever in Russian or Iranian planes and whatever, this is a much tighter relationship. And I think you see that. And I think probably Putin plays the game well with Khamenei, and they sort of have a mutual understanding. So I think it has its origins in a practical sense back to 1990, 91. It's bound on a sort of a mutual dislike and disrespect, or not disrespect, or dislike, or distrust, I should say, of the United States. They share a conspiratorial worldview. It all reinforces and builds into each other. So, you know, it's on a number of different planes, military, political, intellectual, whatever you want to call it. Even though, I have to say, if you look at it in a very practical sense in the 1990s, you know, the Russians are the first people, basically, to dump the Iranians in it if it's in their interest. You know, look at the Caspian. You look at, you know, aspects of the sanctions, for instance. I mean, the Russians had to accept the sanctions for it to go through. They haven't always backed it. But, you know, Lavrov and others have played it reasonably well, and I think that relationship now is much, much tighter. It is, to my mind, one of the failures of Western foreign policy in that sense, that we've actually ceded that territory to the Russians. Not just in Iran, I think probably in large swathes of the Middle East. And the Russians have done it on the cheap. I mean, if you look at that, I mean, this is again the way the journalists have just got. Yeah, do you remember the aircraft carrier going through the channel? And they said, this Armada. I mean, did you see the amount of black smoke coming out of that thing? And it also had its own tug. You're the only one aware that it has its own tug in case it breaks down. This aircraft carrier is ancient. And yet, the way the BBC were reporting it, one would have thought this great Spanish Armada had been coming through the channel. It's ancient stuff. I mean, this is not, but they're doing it because, you know, Obama's red lines don't amount to much. The worry is that, you know, Trump might have too many red lines.
Please.
Hi, my name is Thomas Sharma, recent LSE graduate. I was wondering, with Trump's election and possible, I mean, definite rapprochement with Russia, do you think that will change anything in terms of Saudi-Iranian relations with regards to, well, not lack of relations, with regards to what's happening in Syria and in Yemen?
What
do you think that...
Well, I mean, you see, again, these are all these unknowns that we just don't know what the situation with Trump and Putin is going to be. I mean, obviously, I love the idea, obviously, the Russians all applauded in the Duma, you know, and Trump won. It's difficult to know what that relationship will be. I think there's a view that, you know, obviously, we sort of feel that basically it may be warmer. It certainly would be warmer than if Clinton had been president. But the trouble is, you just don't know what the American posture is going to be, because I don't think John Bolton or even Newt Gingrich, whoever's been touted as possible Secretary of State, are necessarily going to be people who are going to feel very warm towards the Russians. Yeah. So we have to wait and see really on that and see what happens. I think the Saudi one is interesting, of course, because I think the Saudis probably invested quite a bit of time and money on a Clinton victory, and that may not go down well, obviously. But you know, we have to wait and see how that pans out. I think a lot of people in the region, including the Iranians, shouldn't take anything for granted. Just wait and see how that
comes up. Thank you. Please.
I'm Lily Hilton, a student at Haberdashers, our School for Girls. Mm. And I was wondering, I heard the Deputy Chief of Staff for Political Affairs, Hani Davutoglu, say that Brexit presented a historic opportunity for Iran.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was wondering whether you thought there would be any direct benefit or disadvantage for Iran from Britain.
You know, the interesting thing is, I don't know why he thinks it's a great opportunity. I mean, there were a couple of reactions. Of course, you know, the standard Iranian reaction was that this was a great cunning plan. And the way I tried to convince colleagues in Iran that it wasn't, I mean, they said, no, although I have to say now, maybe it was. You know, now with Trump, maybe we did foresee a Trump victory, and, you know, we will go to the front of the queue after. But It's none of my jokes are working tonight. but he always laughs, but he's obviously not now. I know his stuff. I don't know what they think that the opportunity of Brexit for them. There have been some comments. I don't think they've thought about it enormously, to be honest, but some comments that this will weaken Europe or reduce Europe's clout. One person actually I did read said that this is fantastic because Britain is regaining her independence. But I don't really know actually if they've thought through exactly what this means. I assume on a number of them it means that they think Europe will have a weaker hold. But I have to say, if you look at Mogherini's approach to Iran, certainly Nan Zarif, she's very positive. I don't think you can get much more positive than that at the moment within the context of what Europe can and cannot do. So I don't know what they think that Brexit will mean for them. I don't think they actually really, to be honest, I don't really know what Brexit will mean for them. What do we know and why they think it's an opportunity? Other than in a sort of geopolitical sense, but even then it's not clear. It's not clear at all.
Thank you. Some other question? Hey, please. You please.
My name's Aaron Shiri, I'm a SOAS master student. I know that you think I know we think that Mahmoud Rouhani will have a real nice re-election, but who do you think the regime is gonna allow to campaign against him?
Well, I sort of have this sort of view that, in a sense, Rouhani is a weakened Rouhani is better for Khamenei. The better the devil and you keep him there and he's fine. Who they could find to campaign against him? In some ways, not allowing Ahmadinejad to campaign against him is a good move, because Ahmadinejad is a very divisive figure, and it might possibly split that sort of online vote. But there is the possibility that they could get any number of these sort of what we would call a sort of a centre-right by Iranian standards, I think in some ways Rouhani is already centre-right, one of these, someone like Karlibot or someone might step up to the plate or something. I think a lot of these are for show, in a way, and they'll obviously have to have someone running against them. I think the attacks on him because of the economy would mean that some of them would find an opportunity to do so. I tend to sort of agree with you that I don't think it's necessarily going to be a shoo-in for him. People think that, people assume that, and I think in actual fact it's probably become a bit more difficult with the Trump presidency. They might find someone who they'll think is a bit more about. But it's not, entirely clear who it would be at the moment. Because if you're being clever by the Iranian standards, you would keep that fairly secret anyway for the time being, because you wouldn't want to reveal your hand until later in the day, so as to minimise any of the sort of political fallout that might happen in the sort of the pre-campaign. The interesting thing about the last two or three Iranian elections, certainly the last presidential election, was that it had quite a long lead-in. Both of them, actually, 2009, 2013, there was a sort of almost a six-month primary moment when people were debating, is he going to run, is he not going to run, will Khatami run, will Rafsanjani run, and then finally, Rouhani comes through quite late in the day. There's a suggestion that they might pick someone to run against Rouhani quite late in the day, who will either be a tokenistic thing, it could be tokenistic, or they'll find someone who they think will be able to galvanise some popular support. At the end of the day, the system still requires someone who can draw a measure of popular support out. So I think it depends on whether they gauge Rouhani's quote popularity, in a sense, has decreased enough that they can challenge him and bring someone in. But I get the sense that Khamenei would really like a very, very quiet time of it. So if Rouhani's continuing as he is, why not leave him there and you can go through the show? I do think at the end of the day, Iranian elections are good theatre. They're good theatre. You put forward a good piece of theatre, and that's, but nothing really fundamentally, unfortunately, I'd say nothing really fundamentally will change at that level.
Please.
Alaa Yusuf, in a previous incarnation, I was head of Egypt's diplomatic mission to Tehran. Thank you very much. This is very useful, and I think it will be even more useful by January when we know more about the new administration and also in the build-up towards the elections in Iran. However, I was asking, I don't have a crystal ball. Nobody has. Nobody is mortal as well. Is immortal, sorry. So, thinking of what sort of president the establishment would want to see to oversee the transition in case of the disappearance of the leader?
What sort of president? Well, again, I mean, I think that's actually, I think you're quite right to say, and one of the things that I haven't really mentioned, of course, is that I think in the background to all this is the fact that we think in the next 3 to 4 years, certainly there will be a transitional period and the leader will, you know, will be replaced. And I think that's partly what dictates the idea that they want a sort of a very stable sort of presidential system in place. Now, of course, you know, who chooses the new supreme leader is ultimately, in constitutional terms, the Assembly of Experts, and but also other elements that will choose. I don't think the president will necessarily have such a big influence on who comes out, other than also just maintaining that sort of.
Yeah. I mean, what kind of figure do you want to see there? Someone who will not be disruptive, even
as president.
Yeah,
I mean, and I think in Rouhani, in some ways, would be is quite suitable for that. I mean, he's not a, you know, he's not a bad. You certainly don't want an Ahmadinejad figure who would be very, very. Arguably destabilizing. So I think, you know, that's one of the things in the back of the mind. And I you know, I think the great, you know, elephant in the room in that sense is the succession to the leader, which most people aren't, you know, there has been some talk about it. In Iran, obviously, it's died down a bit now. Goodness knows, you know, I think, I don't know what the prognosis is on how long people think he's going to live, but obviously, as you say, you know, even he's not immortal. So it's, you know, it's, you know, you what you're really thinking of, I suppose, is a political system that's at least calm to manage the transition from one leader to the next. And of course, I think a number of people have written on this about who the likely possible successors to him might be. Of course, the argument has been that we hopefully go and see a very liberal or moderate leader or someone a bit more pragmatic. I think there's also been some chit-chat that Rouhani might be seeking it himself. I think that's very unlikely. I think he's been saying that, which is pretty reckless, but anyway. I don't believe it myself. I think there are 3 or 4 candidates that may be up, one of them being Saadia Larijani, of course. I don't think any of them are particular. I mean, this is the unfortunate thing, as people say, is that the new leader may not necessarily be as liberal as the current leader. Okay. Now, what one of the more interesting things about that, of course, is that any new leader would have to take time to consolidate their position. And that may mean that, you know, there will be enough turmoil on that level to keep the rest of it much calmer. But yeah, I mean, I think the argument was last, when was it, March or whatever, that, you know, with the Assembly of Experts and whatever, that you would be in a position to have a group of people who would be able to sort of like basically elect a more moderate leader. And I think that was one of the gambles. And I mean, I have to say, the Obama administration has stayed quite a lot on, I mean, it's I don't know who's advising it on the, or was advising it on domestic Iranian politics, but I think they gambled rather a lot on a lot of changes happening in a favourable way. And maybe the recent election in the United States might be a good lesson for them, that things don't always change in the direction you want. So, yeah, I'm not so sure that whoever succeeds Khamenei is going to be a better thing. You know, we'll have to see. But the candidates that they're listing at the moment, none of them are particularly encouraging, I have to say. But, you know, they're not necessarily worse, but they're not, I don't think, necessarily better.
Thank you. Please.
I'm a student at the University of London. My question is about the recent Kurdish insurgency in Iran. The Democratic Party of Iranian Kurdistan has ended an almost 2-decade ceasefire with Iran indigenous took up arms against the Iranian government. There has been a number of clashes between the Kurdish militia and Revolutionary Guards. And my question is, how do you think the Rouhani administration will sort of view such Kurdish insurgency, and what measures they will take to contain it?
Well, I mean, I don't know enough about what's been happening, but obviously I heard that these things have developed. I mean, if the Rouhani administration goes along the line of every successive Iranian administration pre and post-revolution, but certainly in the 20th and 21st century, is they'll deal with it in a fairly sort of, with a fairly singular idea of what the national interest is, which means probably quite harshly. Yeah, I mean, and this is where the nationalist, you know, ideology in Iran has a lot of traction. The idea, and what worries them, what panics them really, is this idea that Iran will be fractured, you know, will be divided. and they will see this. It's always been a worry for them, just as it has been for the Turks, or the less so than the Turks, but it has been a worry for them that you're going to see these separatist movements either in Balochistan or Azerbaijan or whatever, or now in Kurdistan. And I think it's an issue for them. I don't think it's actually as serious an issue for them as it has been for other regional powers. But you're right, you know, it's something that they, you know, it's slightly, I suppose, diminishes, I suppose, this narrative that they have that they're completely in control of everything, certainly on their borders and what's going on in Iraq and Syria and others, that these things are flaring up. But on the basis of previous practice, then I suspect that it will not be a, you know, they're not going to offer them a referendum. Right? I mean, they're probably sending the troops fairly quickly. If it gets, you know, they will calm down, essentially, is what will happen, I suspect. I mean, we have to see what happens and how big it becomes. But I suspect that in past practice, that's what will happen.
So I would just take the last question, please.
Yeah, go for it, Freddy. Go on.
Freddy, I suggest you
Yeah, I do. Very nice.
It's on the paper, we talked a lot about the implications of people who run the country, the leaders, and their implications for the election, what will happen next. I was very energised by the Green Revolution, kind of bottom-up stuff. I know that historians famously can't predict the future, but is there anything that we can say, not about the kind of kings and queens, but kind of the social around today that is interesting to be having? When's the Arab Spring coming back?
Well, I mean, I don't know if the Arab wouldn't be the Arab Spring. The Persian Sun. You know, the great paradox of Iran, as those of us are familiar, is that politics is always trying to catch up with society. So there's a lot of quite interesting social change going on in Iran. Has been for, you know, decades. Travelers to Iran, you know, those students, whatever, who go particularly to Tehran, but also the other major cities, will find that, you know, you find a much more progressive, shall we say, social environment that you might have anticipated. It's one of the reasons why people come away from Iran, obviously, very almost quite confused or pleasantly surprised, or whatever. You know, but the fact is, the tragedy, in my view, of this sort of political development in Iran is that the politics have always been quite, you know, have always tried to sort of contain or repress that social urge. Yeah. And the question is, you know, how long can you manage that? And periodically, obviously, it hasn't worked very well. If you go from past experience, then we can expect some sort of social upheaval every decade. So, you know, we had one in, obviously, 1979. I think the war probably exhausted people for 1989, but we had something in 1999, then we had something in 2009, so we can now look forward to 2019. I have to say that the repression that took place after 2009 was pretty severe. Okay, it was pretty severe, and of course the arrest of dual nationals and stuff is a continuation of that process in some way. It's to create a degree of uncertainty and it's to create a degree of instability in that sort of social environment. But you have to say that for the reasons that we discussed earlier in terms of the economy, social aspiration, the needs to connect, and, you know, I often think the Iran is a much more connected country than people think. I always just say only the hardliners in the United States and in Iran think that Iran is cut off. You know, I mean, it's a very well connected, people are very connected on social media and other things, not necessarily illegally, but nonetheless they are. So, you know, one has to sort of think that these sort of social, intellectual movements, aspects of globalization, whatever you want to call it, although globalization is now a dirty word, but, you know, it's this sort of thing that is going to have an impact. Now, one of the things that we were discussing earlier is, you know, even these upsurge in nationalist sentiment in Iran and what's going on around these demonstrations in Pasargad and others, these are relatively small scale, by the way. I wouldn't want to exaggerate. You're talking about several thousand people. But it is nonetheless quite interesting what's going on, the mood music, some of these sentiments, the fact that, and I think the clearest sign that there's a little bit of anxiety among the government is that they're arresting people for it. So you've got to say that if you were a betting man, you would say that something, you know, that at the end of the day, what you're seeing in Iran is a sort of a race between the government and society. If the government and the repressive apparatus can maintain a control and always keep an eye, and they're obviously very paranoid about it at the moment, they can keep a lid on it. And as I said, after 2009, they did quite a systematic job of dismantling those sort of elements of sort of the mass movement elements that existed. But there is a sort of a tenacious ability among Iranians that they will I think in time, obviously, coalesce again, reorganize, and things will develop. And there will be crunch times. This politics of managing change, if you will, I think the Iranians, in some ways, the Iranian governments have been reasonably good at doing it. That's not the right word, sorry, reasonably effective, I think, at doing it. I don't think they've been good at doing it, but they've been effective at least at keeping a lid on things. But at the end of the day, I think something will have to give. I think something will have to give, and they won't be able to maintain this forever. At the moment, you know, one of the things that helps them is that the entire region is in a bit of a mess. So, you know, they say to their more progressive elements in Saudi, don't cause trouble, look what happens, you know, in the course of, look at freedom. I mean, this is what happened. So, you know, obviously, while the region is in turmoil, it's less attractive for them. But ultimately, you know, one has to think that there are consequences socially that take, development socially that are taking place that will have an effect on the political structures eventually. I just think myself, I don't have the optimism I had in 2000, to be honest. I think it will clearly be a slower process, and it might be a more traumatic process than people have accepted. Yeah, but these people who are entrenched in power are very, very, very reluctant to let go of that situation. But, you know, it could, you know, things could give. Things could give, and if they're sensible in government, they will adapt. They will adapt. That's the secret of it. But, you know, I think it will, yeah, there will be elements of push and shove that will happen. So let's see, you know, 2019, let's see if it happens on time. But there might be, some, you know, there might be things that will develop by then. And I, you know, don't underestimate the capacity of the Iranians to cause trouble.
So I think that really thanks Professor Ansari, but before I need to announce that the next Middle East Central Asia lecture will be on Wednesday, 23rd of November. Also in this room is Marisa Foyce, gives an overview of Algerian nationalism, so just keeping the nationalists from the 1920s to 1950s. I really thank Professor Ansari for this really interesting and in-depth lecture on the situation. Thanks, Ali, really very much, and thank you all, and show the appreciation to Professor Ansari, please.